kayo'y nakikinig sa SBS Filipino. Pakinggan niyo pa ang kwento sa sbs.com.au/filipino.
Magandang araw at maraming salamat sa inyong pagtutok sa programa ng SBS Filipino. Ako si Vanessa Bragas. Ngayong araw, pag-uusapan natin ang kwento ng pagkakakilanlan, pinagmulan at paghahanap ng koneksyon sa kulturang Filipino. Makakasama natin si Joel De Carteret, isang Filipino adoptee at filmmaker na inampon mula sa Pilipinas noong bata pa at lumaki sa isang Australian family sa Melbourne.
It all started when I was invited by Peter Baines from Hands Across the Water to travel to Thailand to film a documentary series about the incredible work they were doing with children affected by the 2004 tsunamis. And we visited a home that cared for children living with HIV. And I'll never forget that home. The kids were so curious. When we arrived, the kids were so fascinated by the camera. And they crowded around the lens, wanting to see themselves on the screen, laughing and smiling. And then one little boy took my hand and he wanted to show me his world. He showed me where he'd slept. He showed me his books. And then he opened one of them and started reading to me in English. And you could tell he was trying so hard. He was so proud. And I remember him looking at me with these big brown eyes and big smile. And in that moment, it was like I was looking at myself as a five-year-old boy in my own orphanage in the Philippines. And as he kept reading, all these memories started to come back up again about my own story and all the familiar things I was seeing, like the cottages and all the little shoes. Yeah, it just made me start to realize about my own story and, you know, what potentially might have happened to my biological mother. And when I returned home to Sydney and started editing those films, that interaction with that Thai boy just stuck with me. It almost like left this imprint on my heart. And I remember when I finished those films, I said to myself, if I could make these films about people, about family, about home, about connection, and help organizations like Hands Across the Water tell stories that genuinely change lives, then I'd never work a day in my life. It just felt such a privilege to make those films. And for the first time, I became really curious about my own story. And when I became curious about where I came from and about the life I had left behind in the Philippines. And I remember diving into this wormhole of research and researching all adoption agencies in Australia. And within weeks, I connected with the CEO of AdoptChange at that time and Damon Martin from International Social Service. And there was this beautiful full circle about that, because International Social Service was the original organization that facilitated my adoption, you know, like 40 years ago. And so without realizing it, the search for my family had begun after a profound interaction with a little boy in Thailand who unknowingly helped me to see the little boy I'd left behind.
Joe, your own journey eventually led you to find and reconnect with your biological mother in the Philippines. Can you take us through to that journey?
Okay, so yeah, I mean, it's a long journey. Where do I start? I guess I think it all started when I connected with an organization called International Social Service.
Yeah.
At that time, I was looking for support, actually, because I'd seen a lot of psychologists in the past and I was kind of struggling and battling with all these emotions that I didn't really understand what they were. And I saw a few, like, psychologists, and I, you know, the first thing I would say was, I'm adopted. I'm not sure if that sort of, you know, I don't know if that helps you with this sort of, you know, our counselling sessions. And most of the psychologists would just brush past that. And that was like, that kind of told me, oh, okay, it's not a big deal. Like, we'll just, you know. And then as we would go on, that sort of, that kind of support and that help just didn't really hit me. It didn't really speak to me of what are the things that I was actually struggling with. But it was only until I connected with International Social mm-hmm. Service and they presented me with two things.
Yeah.
They presented me with free counselling support for inter-country adoptees, mm-hmm. which was wild because I'd spent so much money trying to get help with psychologists and all that kind of stuff. And being an artist, you know, I don't have much money for that kind of thing, you know, like, so that free support was like, wow. And when I saw my psychologist for the first time, I realized that she had built her practice mm-hmm. around supporting people with this type of trauma, with this type of relinquished trauma. And some of the, you know, things that I was struggling with, she actually helped me actually create language around mm-hmm. it, you know, around my struggle with identity, with my struggle around where I belong, where I fit in, and also to like the struggle of culture. You know, I know that I'm from the Philippines, but I have no understanding of what culture is.
Yeah.
In you know, beyond the basics of Tagalog, but what is the culture? You know, I do a lot of work with Indigenous culture. I teach at NASDA and I do cultural films around Indigenous stories, and so I've been really understanding, like, and learning this really the depth of Indigenous Aboriginal culture and some mm. of the cultural practices and protocols around that. And so there was no sort of information around this at the time. And so when I could speak and express what I was going through, and when I felt heard and when I felt understood, I started to realize that this is a thing. This is a real deep experience that adoptees go through
mm-hmm.
and are battling, navigating this alone.
Yeah.
You know?
So your psychologist gave you the bigger picture of what you're experiencing.
Exactly. Yeah. And gave me language around mm-hmm. it. Like this is this and this is that and this is very common and this is why, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part of that was they offered free tracing services for inter-country adoptees. So growing up,
mm-hmm.
when I would look at my orphanage papers, and it was always from different periods of my time when I was maybe potentially struggling with a lot of like identity and my place in this world, I'd always look at those papers and it was always very hopeless because it was like no information, you were found, you didn't know your parents, and it was just the same narrative. It was just virtually impossible. So for an adoptee, this was like a glimmer of hope. Okay, so if an organization does this professionally and has all this structure and contacts in the Philippines, maybe it might be possible to even just find a record.
Yeah.
Or even to find my actual date of birth. Because all my life I was given a date of birth, 4th of August, but that was just given to me because of documents or the, you know, official practices when a child is found.
Yeah, by the taxi driver.
Yeah, but it's not my date of birth. It's not when I was born.
Yes.
And so, like when people talk about star signs and astrology and like moon rising and all those sort of things that we are part of our identity and something that we are given, and it's like our birthright is like, this is where you were born, and we go by that as
we understand our personality.
Exactly. Yeah. Understand our personality, understand our traits, understand what we struggle with, you know. So that was like, even a date of birth would be just incredible, you know. Like, say maybe perhaps we could find a cousin or something, and if my parents had been passed away, you know, God forbid, I might have been going, okay, well, yeah, but he's, you know, this is when he was born. So that was my hope. It was like, I knew that everyone was telling me, and papers would say that it was impossible.
Yeah.
But maybe just perhaps I could find the date that I was born.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of that, you know, that sort of proof that I kind of existed in this world, you know, that kind of fingerprint of like, okay, that's who I am, and now I can kind of start building upon that, you know?
So in that way, Joe, you understood yourself, your identity, and where you belong.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, from there, you know, it was like the minute I started doing that process of writing my narrative and sending it to International Social Service, and they would then kind of contact their contacts in the Philippines. And then I think within like maybe a couple months or something, they came back and said, "I'm sorry, we can't. There's no information that we can get from our contact in the Philippines." And so I said, "Well, you know, my Aussie mum, you would always say, if you want something done, you've got to do it yourself."
Yes, that's really beautiful words. Yeah. Mm.
And so I sat my mum down when she was in Sydney, and I said to her, at this Thai restaurant, I said, "Mum, I'm going to go back to the Philippines and I'm going to retrace my steps and I'm going to, you know, even just go back to the orphanage. Maybe there was something that they'd missed or they, you know." And my mum was very worried, of course.
Yes.
You know, she's like, "Oh, Joel, like, you know, like, what are you going to do when you come home and you're disappointed?
Because there's no information.
There's no information.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where do you start?
Where do you start? Yeah.
Yeah.
And for an adoptive parent who's gone through their own stuff and also wanting to protect their child from not just disappointment, right? Because this is not just, "Oh, that didn't happen," and, "Oh, that's okay, we'll forget about it." But this is deeply rooted in our yearning to discover who we are.
Yes.
Like, that's just the primal need of, like, understanding who we are, who are our parents, and where do we come from? Like, where do we really come from? Like, what is our lineage? What's my mum and dad's lineage?
Yes.
You know?
And it's important because we will know ourselves better and more and very deep.
Deep, yeah. Yeah, like the very fabric of who we are as not just a person, but, you know, like, I've been doing a lot of deep work around ancestry and understanding our ancestors and drawing strength from them when I feel very hopeless and feel lost. You know, like, that's a big part of this journey too, is connecting with our ancestors. Yeah. Because our ancestors are warriors, you know, they're healers, they're shamans, they're, you know, like, we have a rich, rich, deep history.
Yes.
And this is what adoptees don't know, you know, this is part of who we are. And so anyway, went to the Philippines, I took 3 months off and I put work aside and just based myself out of Quezon City and did a lot of support work before. Like, I spoke to my psychologist a lot of times. I seeked out adoptee mentors and I did a lot of background research. I found a translator so that person could, Dee could help me translate and navigate me around not just the culture, but language and the cultural way of doing things.
Yeah. So you have built your team there in the Philippines.
And then I found film crew in the Philippines to help me document.
Yes.
Because I just didn't want to be like a camera like this. Yeah. I wanted to just be immersed in what I was doing and just let people
get raw videos of you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just document the process. And, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I thought that if someday, one day, if I'm blessed with a family, that I could show my children when they would say, "Where does your mother come from?" Or "Who is your father?" And I could go, "Anak, sit down, and I'm going to show you something."
Yes.
And this is where I come from, and play them a little film, because that's how we learn. We learn through stories.
Yes.
We learn through storytelling. So it was a roller coaster ride. I went back to the orphanage. It brought up a lot of feelings. One of the things I observed in the orphanage was that there was a lot of mixed race kids. So there was a lot of mixed race orphans. So expats that would have affairs with Filipino women, and then they would leave. Mm. And then these Filipino women wouldn't be able to look after them. Yeah. And so there was these mixed race kids in an orphanage.
Mm.
And my heart was just... A lot of the things I saw there was pretty tough.
Mm.
And, you know, 30 years later, going back to my orphanage, It was very, very, very run down. I came from an orphanage called Reception Center for Children.
In QC, Quezon City.
RSCC, Reception Study Center for Children. And it was it's a government-run, owned orphanage, and it was very run down. Mm-hmm. Very run down. Got my orphanage documents, and everything was the same as back home because we had taken copies. And there was one mother carer that had been there the entire time, and actually met my original mother carer too, which was a beautiful experience just to see her again. And then I went back to the market where I was found, Munoz Market in Quezon City. So I spent a lot of time there. I spent a lot of time walking around the market, walking around the outer regions. Like I basically just drew a big circle around that region. And with that circle, I was basically going to a lot of churches, a lot of barangays. I printed out a photo of myself and just some key dates of when I was found and what had happened. During that time, it was around Christmas time, so I was
busy.
Spending a lot of time at the churches. I'd even printed out big big canvas signs, and churches would allow me to put signs up there. And I was just praying that someone would recognize me. Because when a child goes missing in a community, in a village, it's never forgotten. Mm. People never forget that. And I was just hoping that someone somewhere would recognize me. We had this surprising lead by a storeholder within a month. Mm. And that storeholder was Badan, who we are very good friends now. Like, they call them my Munoz Market family now. Yeah. But they helped me a lot during that time. And they knew one of their relatives had lost a child, Dante, back then. And they reached out to the mother, Vicky, and we met. And I showed Vicky a photo of 12 children in the orphanage, and she pointed straight at me and said, that's Dante. So for the first time, we got our first lead. Mm. And that first lead was just a roller coaster, because I started to get to know their family. All their family had come and came to the market, and I visited some of their relatives, and they were like, Dante. And so we were getting very, very, very close, because they thought it was me.
Yeah.
But then after a month, when we sent through a DNA test and we waited a month and we came back, I got the big devastating blow that it wasn't her. And it was this fear that my mum was always worried about, was that big disappointment. Mm. And so, you know, now it was 2 months.
Yeah.
Right, so it was a month finding that lead, and then it was a month connecting with Dante's family and waiting for that confirmation that this was family.
Yeah.
And that blow and that hit of my mum was right, and I changed my trip. I said I'm going home in a week. This is it. I'm done. Mm. I was tired, and I was running out of money. Because Philippines is not cheap.
Yeah.
It's actually not cheap, right?
It's true.
It is not cheap. And I was staying in a place called BGC.
Mm. That place is not cheap.
That place is not cheap, right? Yeah. I didn't know the ins and outs of how to live cheaply in the Philippines. And the film crew wasn't cheap either.
Yes.
You know? And I felt like at times people like trying to like, because I was a foreigner, people like, oh, this guy's got money.
Mm.
This guy's got money. Would you keep charging him, you know?
I'm sorry to cut you. I just wanted to ask, when you tell that story, what's going through your mind after that first heartbreak? Did you ever wish that you were that day.
Yeah. Oh yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Like it was a big disappointment for me because Vicky's family and Badan's family were just so kind, and I felt like this was my family. Mm. This was the family I was always looking for. You know, they were so kind. They never asked me for money, ever. They never asked me for money. Mm. They would always meet me. They'd always host me at the market. I'd come to the market, and they'd always provide water and snacks. And then they're always like, "Have you eaten?" And they always give me... And I would always try to give no, you know,
yeah.
And that was the family I was hoping for, yeah. You know. I was like, this is my family, yeah. And so I was devastated. I was really upset that, and also too, I felt a bit guilty because, you know, I felt like I'd kind of, I don't know, misled them, or I don't know. I felt guilty because, I could see the disappointment on their faces. And I remember Badan was like, "I don't believe it. Let's do it again. I'll pay. Oh. I'll pay to do it again." It was like, and it's like expensive.
Yes.
You know, and these are market holders, market store holders. They don't earn much money. And what I found in this structure of family, and I'm sure it's quite common, is that a lot of the storeholders have all these different stores, and they would all earn a bit of money, and that it would all come back into a centralized place, like Badan, he's like the elder, they're the oldest, and it would all come there, and then he would give all the money to everyone. So everyone would have an equal share, and so that everyone was looked after. So no matter if you were, you know, selling, you know, snacks,
yeah.
and maybe you got one, maybe you sold two things, That's not gonna.
You're not gonna survive to
eat, you know.
Yeah.
So I found with this family is that, you know, everyone did their part.
Yes.
In the community, in their family, and then all the money would funnel to a centralized place, and then Badan would give everyone, making sure that everyone could eat and everyone was looked after.
Yeah.
So I was like, this is the essence of family for me. This was the family that I always had hoped for, and the fact that we went family made me realize, oh well, yeah, I don't, this is not my family.
And but at that point, Joel, do you feel like you're getting closer to finding who your
mother? No. Well, like, you know, when that kind of DNA test came, it was like that was a big hit, but at the same time, the media had kind of picked up the story finally. And I have to say, because when I first contacted them, they didn't contact me back. No one contacted me back because it's a dead end. It's a dead end story. So for producers to invest money into something that has a dead end, it's not viable to follow a cold lead.
Yeah.
And this is straight from a producer.
Mm.
But the minute they knew I had a lead, and the minute they knew it was certain, they poured all this. And also they knew that I was a filmmaker, and I gave them all this material out of my own resources, right? I paid for all this film crew to capture all this stuff, and I was filming it myself as well. So for a producer, this was great.
Yes.
Here's a filmmaker who's done a lot of work. He's got all these, like, clips of him doing the journey over now 2 months. He's found a lead, right? Great, let's do a story on him.
It's a perfect pitch.
It's a perfect pitch. It's a perfect pitch.
Yeah.
And so they were there
at
the DNA test, right? So they had released an announcement, and then they were all cameras on this on this DNA test. So you can imagine, right? It's like, I hope it was my birth mother, of course. But then I hope, because the whole nation is watching, you know. And when it was a negative, literally straight after, one of the producers said, "There's a new lead." Someone had come forward from Japan that had seen the segment on Jessica Soho.
Yeah.
Because I found that a lot of Filipinos that go abroad, they're still very connected to Filipino mm-hmm. culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so their subscriptions, their TV subscriptions, will always have Filipino shows and channels, right? GMA, I don't know. And so there was someone who was living in Japan. Her name was Dolly, and she was living in the house where I had walked off from. And she was actually babysitting me at the time.
Wow.
And she knew me. She'd always be looking after me when I was young. And so she recognized me, and she said, "That's Joelle." And she communicated to her sister, who was in the Philippines, and they got this little can of photos. That's how they store photos back then, a little can of photo, the crackdown of the can.
Maybe the biscuit cans.
Yeah. And then it was like this wild thing, and I got a couple of messages from this Dolly person I didn't know at the time, and also someone else. Who was it? I got this message from someone, and at this time now there was lots of people sending me messages. A lot of people were messaging me for their own help, requesting their own help as well, because they had lost people as well. And then someone had sent me this photo. I think it was the night before, but I was too frazzled, and it didn't even register. And then it came up again, and there was this little boy sitting on the lap of this mother, and it was her name was Linda. And for the first time, someone said, this boy's name's Joelle.
How did you feel when you learned that that's your real name?
Well, I knew my name was Joel, and I never really remembered anyone calling me Joelle when I came to Australia. But I just remember how beautiful my mother was. I just remember how beautiful she looked. And I was there sitting on her lap. I was with pudgy face. I looked like I was hungry. And it was this group photo of all the people that had lived there or in this little shack. And I'm talking a little shack, like probably this.
Like a bike wheel or?
This a little shack on a busy road in Quezon City with about eight people living there. The story that Dolly tells me after I went and, fasted, because this story is... But the story that Dolly tells me after when I actually visited her in Japan was that when she approached the landlord to try to get a room, because she was a single mother, she had a child, she was desperately needing a place to live with me, she said that the place was full, I'm sorry, I can't, and she begged and begged and begged and begged and begged. And so the landlord actually converted our little area, which was a pig pen, she converted that into a little room for us. So the story goes was that morning I woke up and my birth mother wasn't there. And because like the first instinct of a child is to find their mother or, where's my mother, where's my mother? So I walked out of the house. All the neighbors, all the flatmates saw me walk out, but they just thought that I was just going to play outside. But I walked outside and then wandered off trying to find her, and that's how I got lost. And that's the story that Dolly tells me when she first contacted me. Like, you walked off from the house. We saw you, but we thought you were just going to be outside playing with the neighbors.
Yeah. So, Joe, right now you're... what happened then? Did you do DNA test again?
Well, okay, so then in the next month, right, was just about finding Linda, right? And this was the name that everyone knew her to be, Linda. And it basically set this nationwide search for my birth mother.
Yeah.
Like, the whole nation got behind it now.
We
filmed another announcement. And this was very rare for Jessica Soho. This was like the second announcement that was made.
It's like a series now. It was like a series.
Yeah. It was a big series. But the only problem was, the only problem was that when I would show this photo, I wish I had it, but I can send it if you can use it. But the problem was that we were looking for someone 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And so when I was showing this photo to a lot of Filipinos in the area, people were mistakenly thinking that that was the photo of that was the woman. That would, but it was like 30 years later, so she would have been in her 50s.
Mm. Mm.
So a lot of the times I felt like it was like a wild goose chase, you know, like it's like an Australian term of like being sent all around in circles.
Mm.
There was lots of sightings in different areas. So every sighting that we heard of, I went there, you know, there was like churches and different areas. We found ourselves at Manila North Cemetery, which is one of the biggest cemeteries in the Philippines. Mm. And I don't know if you've been there.
No, I haven't.
But there's people living there.
Yes. Mausoleums are on some corners.
Yeah. There's like massive, like there's like a massive community that live there. And there's stores, there's markets, there's karaoke. Everyone lives there. And so I spent a good 2 weeks at the cemetery because someone said, "We saw your mother there." And so we spent a lot of time at the funeral walking around trying to find Linda. And then it was, again, it was coming close to when I had to leave. You know, I had changed my flight now 3 times. And I think at that this point, you know that feeling of like you're so close but yet you're so far? You know, like you've got some sort of tangible evidence that like this is her, this, like we know who she is, but we still can't find her because it was a photo that was like taken 30 years ago. And then meanwhile, like this story had just blown up in the Philippines. It became like such a big well-known story, even to the point where a lot of people would get off the jeepney at Munoz Market and take photos of the Munoz Market because it was such an iconic place now for this story. And we were very fortunate enough for Mike Enriquez to invite us onto primetime radio. Radio was such a powerful medium there in the Philippines. And he did a nationwide announcement on in the Philippines on primetime radio in the morning. And next thing I know, at about midnight, I get a call from the producer of GMA and said, "I think we might have found someone. She's come forward saying that she's your mother."
Yeah.
We verified the lead from the neighbors who were living in there, and they have verified her story. But we can't be sure. We can't be sure, you know. But she wants to meet you, and we're going to have you meet at Munoz Market again.
So where were you found?
Where I was found, yeah.
Okay, Joe, can you take us on that day that you were reunited with your biological mom?
Lucky I got it on camera because everything was quite a blur. You know, I was running on very limited sleep and it all was sort of happening very quickly. And I was actually in disbelief that everything was going on, like, and everything was really progressing at a fast pace. Standing at Munoz Market, leaning on this sort of fence where they had told me to wait.
Yeah,
it was just a bit sort of taken back by it because not only was I going through the biggest moment of my life, but there was like 10 cameras around as well. So it was just, it was all a lot. It was a lot. But when I laid eyes on my birth mother for the first time, and prior to that, actually, a really important information that I forgot to mention was that when the producer of GMA called me and said that they had this lead, they had this woman that
was claiming to be your birth mother, she actually said that her name was Herminia, not Linda. The moment I laid my eyes on my birth mother, Herminia, for the very first time, I was actually a bit startled because it wasn't this image that I was forming in my head based on the photo that I'd seen 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And because of that, I was like, oh, is this my birth mother? Like, am I going to go through this whole experience again with Nana Vicky? And I was just a bit awkward. And she sort of handed me these photos straight to me. And she was like, are you Georgia? I was like, yeah. Like, are you Herminia? Yeah. And she gave me these photos and I looked at them and it was this, like, these photos of myself that I'd never seen at all. Like, it was like these photos of me that I was looking at the first time. And I was slowly, like, you know, slowly trying to believe or wanting to believe that this was her. And then when I looked over and there was Nana Julie and Arabella, who we had found beforehand, who were living with her at the time, they nodded at me and said, that's her, that's your Nana. Mm. And that was then when I was, like, starting to, like, all these emotions were starting to surface.
Yeah.
And the, I guess, you know, a combination of lack of sleep and a relief that my journey was ending. Mm. And then the deep sense of sadness that I was feeling when Herminia sort of collapsed in my arms and was just sobbing uncontrollably. And it was a combination of relief but also sadness that we had lost so much time.
Yes. Muling mapapakinggan ang panayam na ito bilang podcast sa aming website sbs.com.au/Filipino, SBS Audio App at iba pang podcast streaming platform at mapapanood sa SBS Filipino YouTube channel. Maraming salamat sa inyong pag-antabay sa aming usapan.
Nice yung bang makinig na iba pang kwento na tulad ito? Makinig sa Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Spotify o sa iba pang podcast apps.